The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is your producer, Sam Livingston. Mr. Fleury's having me do the show today. I'm having to pre-record it because Ed Stone is just preparing for PYC, so there's a lot of activity going on around here, and I wouldn't have anyone to produce the show for me if I were doing it live, so I've decided to go ahead and pre-record it. I apologize that it will be light on the news. For the first segment today, I'm going to talk about Ben Rhodes' new book. Ben Rhodes, he was the chief national security advisor all 8 years of Barack Obama's presidency, and he's come out with his new book. So we'll look at that for the first half of today, some highlights from that book. And then in the second half, I'd like to get into a little bit more of William Manchester. You've heard a lot about him lately if you've been listening to the show, more about Churchill. But I'd like to focus more on one of Churchill's favorite poets, Rudyard Kipling. So we'll read some poems from him, and hopefully that will be a fun segment for everyone. Just to start off this first half here, talking about Ben Rhodes' new book. His book is titled The World As It Is, and this came out, I think it was a month or two ago, and I've been kind of picking away at it here and there. You'll probably remember him, especially if you've listened to the show, as he is the fiction writer who became the foreign policy guru for the Obama administration. We talked a lot about his that New York Times piece that wrote about him and how he crafted the narrative to really sell the Iran deal to the press and to the American public. You remember that phrase, the echo chamber, a lot. So we'll get to that point in his book as well. And now we're almost, 18 months on from the election of President Donald Trump. And it can be easy to say, well, why talk about the Obama administration? They're out of office. But if you listen to this show, it's as if they're more relevant than ever. I mean, you talk about the deep state and you see what's going on. Now, this was anything but, a peaceful transition of power, as they said it would be. There are some deeply rooted figures there, holdovers from the Obama years. And if you listen to the show, you're, of course, well up to date with that. And I think Ben Rhodes' book, it'll help us understand a little bit more about this administration and their promise to fundamentally transform the United States of America. And just a few comments about the book. I don't want to spend too much time on it. I wasn't expecting this to be a great, uplifting book. I was just going through it to find some details more about the Obama years. A few things that stood out to me were just, it came across as if, all those 8 years, Benjamin Netanyahu was America's greatest foe. It wasn't Iran. It wasn't Russia or China. It was Netanyahu that got in the way of everything. Fox News was like a propaganda arm of a fascist party. Everything, they're constantly having to battle Fox News. Donald Trump is threaded throughout the book. There's a lot of, really just nasty things that he's written about him. There's one section in there, it was about two full pages of just Rhodes' stream of thought about how much he does not like Mr. Trump. And you really see that. He talks about them having a meeting after President Trump or after Donald Trump was elected, and a lot of officials in the Oval Office are crying about this. So it wasn't like I said earlier, this peaceful transition of power. There was a lot of emotion in there. They knew everything that they'd worked for was under threat now. One phrase that came up a lot in his book was conspiracy theories. If you really do anything or challenge the the press releases from the White House, or if you have some more critical thoughts and ask some deeper questions, well, Ben Rhodes doesn't really address those as much. You're just peddling conspiracy theories, and that's about as much as he gives to that. He doesn't really answer the critics a lot in this book. It's just, you know, if you second guess the government, if you second guess us, we're the White House, we're the ones in power, well, you're just believing or peddling conspiracy theories. Another thought that I had was, you know, so much for being the most transparent White House in history. And that will come through a lot as we just go through some highlights from this book. One thing that stood out to me is just seeing the effect that those 8 years had on America, on the American institutions, on the American public, and especially with young people. They're kind of hypnotized by Barack Obama, and we're getting all of these phrases today. One thing that really hits me as just crazy is this idea of your truth. You know, you can interpret the facts the way you want to. And Mr. Obama is on a speaking tour right now in Africa, and he's talking a lot about facts. He's talking about how we can't argue with facts, and that's true. But when you look at the history and the track record, facts are only what they determine facts to be. And he's very shrewd. It's really a smart play because he's coming across, you know, down the line. You know, you don't want to be too extreme, but he really has a hold over the media and the public, as you would read in Mr. Gerald Fleury's book, America Under Attack, and his book, Great Again. You know, we are still experiencing the legacy of that administration. It's out of office, but that legacy is still there. Just a quick quote from Mr. McDonald's article. This is from January 2017. It's titled, Barack Obama's Eternal Legacy. Eternal Legacy. He says, as president, Mr. Obama endorsed multiple issues that fundamentally transformed the culture, economy, and security of the United States. He endorsed these issues, and just because he's out of office doesn't mean all of those things can be undone. You look at the effect that he had on America, and it's not something that just disappears with a new policy. The most fundamental transformation, Mr. McDonald writes, the most fundamental transformation President Obama accomplished can be seen in each of his actions, lawlessness. And we still see the effects of that. We see it in the media. We see it a lot on the college campuses throughout America. And Rhodes's book, it's a reminder, really, of, you know, how did this get mainstream? How did these ideas, you know, make it straight up to the top? One thing that jumped out to me throughout his book was their strange obsession with history. They'll talk a lot about history, but as far as actually looking back at history, all they really talk about is colonialism and slavery. So Rhodes kind of sits there as though he's got history in his hands, and they're now in this position to shape history. They're really concerned about how they will be remembered, but not so much about actually being taught by history, letting the past inform them. It's more about their legacy. They're so concerned about being on the right side of history. I'd just like to read a paragraph from Thomas Sowell's book. I'm going through this. He's got a lot of books. This one is titled The Vision of the Anointed. He says, if such an idea, we're just jumping into a thought here, if such an idea were fully accepted, this would mean that opposing arguments on social policy were arguments about methods, probabilities, and empirical evidence. With compassion, caring, and the like being common features on both sides, thus canceling out and disappearing from the debate. That clearly is not the vision of the anointed. One reason for the preservation and insulation of a vision is that it has become inextricably intertwined with the egos of those who believe it. Despite Hamlet's warning against self-flattery, the vision of the anointed is not simply a vision of the world and its functioning in a casual sense, but it is also a vision of themselves and of their moral role in that world. It is a vision of differential rectitude. It is not a vision of the tragedy of the human condition. Problems exist because others are not as wise or as virtuous as the anointed. And that really is, I think, the main theme of this book is, you know, we didn't do anything wrong in those 8 years. Everything we did was right. And it was the world as it is that prevented us from creating the world as it should be. Our vision, bringing our vision to light. Just a few quotes here from his book. This is right after President Trump or Donald Trump wins the election. Rhodes writes, "For the first time in 8 years, history felt out of our hands. You know, we couldn't shape history anymore." When he's trying to defend Obama's reluctance to intervene in Syria, he writes, "As usual, Obama's case depended upon a much longer view of history. He was wiser. He was smarter. He could see further into the future than anyone else." When they're talking about ousting Hosni Mubarak, Rhodes says, "We had a moral responsibility to be on the right side of history. We had a moral responsibility to be on the right side of history." And, well, you know, there's a lot. Obviously, now I wouldn't look back at that history and say they were on the right side of it. But what does that even mean? How do they define the right side of history? It really is just their vision. And we're not as educated. We're not as enlightened as they are. When Rhodes was hired to work for Barack Obama, he and Samantha Powers, they said they felt a sense of destiny about working for the Obama administration. Rhodes wrote that when he would go home at night and he would sit at his desk thinking that he was part of a movement that would remake the world order. He said, thinking that I was part of a movement that would remake the world order. You know, this wasn't about... It was more about him. It was more about his place in history. Later on I think this is about the year 2015. There's a lot of events going on here, and some of the Obama officials are getting a little sad. And Rhodes writes that Obama was more sanguine about the forces at play in the world, not because he was late in recognizing them. You know, it wasn't because he didn't know what was going on, but because he'd seen them earlier. You know, he's so wise. He's been around for so long. He understands how the world works, and we really just need to catch up to him. We really need to see the world the way he sees it, because he's not letting this bother him. And it's not because he doesn't know what's going on. It's because he's so much wiser. He has so much more foresight than we do. It was all about having the world catch up to Barack Obama. And that comes right at the outset of the book. Rhodes is sitting across from Obama, and Obama looks at him and says, "What if we were wrong?" And Rhodes replies, "Wrong about what? Maybe we push too far. Maybe people just want to fall back into their tribe. I don't know," he said. "Sometimes I wonder whether I was 10 or 20 years too early. You know, I was just, you know, I'm not wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. The presidency was flawless. There wasn't a single scandal. We did everything right. You know, I regret nothing, but it's the world as it is. They just weren't ready for me. They just weren't ready for what I had to bring to the table." You know, it's Barack Obama's vision of the world as it should be. And that is the conflict that they faced all through the presidency. That's the way this book is set up. You know, our vision is right. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. We don't have any history to back it up. But, you know, we're on the right side of history. And, you know, anything that would challenge us or that gets in our way, that's the world as it is. And that's wrong. It's technocrats. Well, like Thomas Sowell calls them, it's the vision of the anointed. It's their vision of the world. One minor point that came across, as I mentioned earlier, throughout the whole book was how much they disliked working with Benjamin Netanyahu. They would share jokes about him when he wasn't around. There are a lot of phrases like this. Obama is talking to Ben Rhodes, I just can't make Bibi want peace. You know, it's Bibi's fault. He's the one getting in the way of the two-state solution. He's the one getting in the way of dealing with Iran. It's all his fault. And if he was out of the way, you know, he's the world as it is, and we represent the world as it should be. And if I can get rid of him, well, we can form our world. We can deal with Iran the way we want to. Some strong words. You know, he's in a lot of ways, well, no, just black and white. He is stronger in condemning Benjamin Netanyahu in this book than he is Iran. Just one paragraph here to illustrate that. In the early months of 2012, there was real concern that there was going to be a war between Israel and Iran. The Iranian nuclear program continued to advance, but threats out of Israel were becoming more bellicose. Threats out of Israel. And there were signs that a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities could be imminent. You know, the immediate threat, the big concern here is not that the Iranian nuclear program is advancing. It's that Israel is, they're more aggressive. They're not as willing to make peace. They're considering striking one of Iran's nuclear facilities. And then the rest of the page is like, well, how do we calm him down? It is hard to make any sense out of Barack Obama's Middle East foreign policy. Mr. Gerald Flurry wrote in America Under Attack, and really what you see in a lot of those decisions, you know, it's hard to see logic in it, what was going on. But if you look at it from the point of view as trying to hit or hurt Israel, you think about what was happening in Egypt, even in Syria and Iraq, you know, you're destabilizing the world around your closest ally in the Middle East. Mr. Gerald Flurry writes in America Under Attack on page 21, the current U.S. administration is demonstrating in a number of ways, he wrote this in 2013, that it does not like the Jews. Israeli leaders recognize that the alliance between these two nations can no longer be trusted, and they are being driven to desperation. They must be asking why this administration harbors such antipathy for them. They don't understand, and even the people who have that bitter feeling toward them often don't understand. Never has there been such a hateful foreign policy in America toward our best ally in the Middle East. Now, one section that stood out to me was when Obama was talking to Hosni Mubarak, and Hosni Mubarak is the leader of Egypt. They've been friendly towards Israel for 30 or 40 years, going back to Anwar Sadat in the early 70s, and there's an uprising, and Obama says, well, I think it's time for you to go. And he's got all of his advisors sitting there. The young guys are encouraging him to tell Mubarak to step down. The more senior advisors in the Oval Office are saying, don't tell him to step down. We need to support him. We need to back him. If he goes, it's just going to swirl into chaos. But it was really, you know, he went with the young guys. And he asked Mubarak to step down. And Mubarak knew that if he didn't have America backing him, he wouldn't make it. And then Rhodes is remembering this exchange here with Obama about this decision. And he says, quoting Obama, you know, he said, one of the things that made it easier for me is that I didn't really know Mubarak. He mentioned that George H.W. Bush had called Mubarak at the height of the protest to express his support. But it's not just Bush. The Clintons, Gates, Biden, they've known Mubarak for decades. I thought of Biden's perennial line, this is Rhodes speaking, all foreign policy is an extension of personal relationships. If it had been King Abdullah, Obama said, referring to the young Jordanian monarch with whom he'd struck up a friendship, I don't know if I could have done the same thing. You know, I didn't know Mubarak as well, so it was easier for me to ask him to step down. If it was Jordan and if it was King Abdullah, you know, they had some protests there for a little while in the White House. It sounded like they were going to ask him to step down. And peaceful little Jordan there. And, well, now we kind of get a look into why he didn't. Why did he back out of Jordan? If he was encouraging Mubarak in Egypt, if he was telling Gaddafi, if he bombed Gaddafi out of Libya, well, what happened in Jordan? Well, I was just too good of friends with King Abdullah. I couldn't tell him to leave, but it was easier for me to tell Mubarak to leave. I mean, you talk about thinking and ruling like a king. I like him, he can stay. I don't like him, he goes. Forget what the geopolitical status of the area is. Forget what your closest ally is encouraging you to do. And not only that, forget what some of your senior advisors are telling you to do. Now, that's a decision based on what the young guys say and, you know, based on my friendship with that individual. You know, it was his attempt to shape the Middle East. It was according to his vision, and it really didn't make a whole lot of sense unless you look at that hatred of Israel and just really ruling like a king in a lot of ways. Mr. Fleury says, "Can you explain these decisions with any logic? Many people can see these are disastrous decisions, but we must understand that this isn't simply the result of ineptitude on the part of this administration or naivety about how the world really works. We are seeing the after effects of a calculated, aggressive, satanic attack aimed at weakening and ultimately destroying the nations of Israel, starting with the world's most powerful nation." You know, you couldn't explain it with logic at the time. It was confusing. You know, it's one policy in Egypt, it's a different one in Libya, it's another one in Syria, and then they'll kind of wash it away and say, well, you weren't in the Situation Room, so you can't be critical of the decisions we were making. But, you know, you read these books, and it sounds like a lot of what was driving the decision wasn't history, it wasn't advice from senior aides, it was, well, we need change for the sake of change, and the young guys, you know, they've got it right, and I'm just going to help my friends out over here because I know him better than I know him. And at the time, there's no logic to that. But now we're seeing more and more of how they reasoned in the White House. And I think a lot of this was probably the funniest part of the book for me. I think Obama definitely knew that he wasn't liked by the Jewish community or by Israel. And he can't understand why. You know, why would I do anything to hurt Israel? You know, he's trying to reconcile with them. And this part of the book, this is page 56, Rhodes says, "The most heavily scrutinized section was about Israel and the Palestinians." I can't remember what this part is about. I think it's some agreement they made. Oh, sorry, it's his Cairo speech. This is Barack Obama's Cairo speech in 2009. Right afterwards, "The most heavily scrutinized section was about Israel and the Palestinians, an issue that also drew on the varied aspects of Obama's background. On the one hand, he had deep roots in the Chicago Jewish community, which has been historically close to Israel." Now, that was news to me that he had deep roots in the Chicago Jewish community, but when he's trying to be on somebody's side, he just, well, why would I be against you? I'm from the same area you are. You know, I see things the way you see them. I grew up in Chicago's Jewish community, and I hadn't heard that one before. Rhodes actually has some Jewish background, and he's talking to Obama about it. And Obama replies, "Me too. I came out of the Jewish community in Chicago. I'm basically a liberal Jew." And I just had a good laugh at that one. I've been through his autobiography, and that doesn't come out anywhere. I think I know what he's probably trying to get at with that comment. But you really look at Obama, and it's kind of like he can be whoever he needs to be depending on the crowd he's trying to appeal to. You know, he's a Muslim from Indonesia. He's the anti-colonialist from Kenya. He's the oppressed African-American from the south side of Chicago and Hawaii. And now when he needs, you know, Israel on his side, he's the liberal Jew who grew up in Chicago. He just picks a personality whenever it's convenient. Mr. Gerald Fleury writes in Great Again just about how much the media failed to vet Barack Obama and look at those communist roots. He says, "Mr. Obama is not the person most people think he is. He has a manufactured persona that he wants you to see. It is stunning how much and how often the government of this land is exposed for being deceitful. Everything revolves around deceit. Americans have practically come to accept this as a fact of politics today, but it is deeply disturbing and will have dangerous consequences." A manufactured persona. He can create the illusion that he is, you know, something he's not. And where's the media? Where's the public outcry? Now, he did work with a community organizer on the South Side of Chicago. And he moved to the South Side of Chicago in his mid to late 20s, so he didn't grow up there. And he worked on the South Side, and I'm not aware of a strong Jewish community down there. But he did work for this organization called the Gamaliel Foundation, which is a community organizing group, and the head of that group was Jewish. So the 3 or 4 years that he may have spent there might be what he's getting at with saying, I was brought up basically a liberal Jew. But again, you know, I've had experiences too, but I don't claim to be something like that. I don't just say, yeah, I know exactly where you're coming from because I was brought up this way when I just had, you know, a brief experience there. Anyway, they're fine with lying. They're fine with telling these half-truths to illustrate, you know, their point. And that's the final thing that I want to get into with this book, is that lying is okay. And Obama, he was the law in a lot of ways. You hear a lot of these, read a lot about Rhodes and the speechwriters, and you know, they're looking back at books and where can we pull quotes out? And Obama can just come in with his pen and rewrite the whole thing. And it doesn't have to be factually accurate. Obama said it. That's gold. You know, whatever. And they're just hypnotized by him when he spoke. Rhodes talks about how when he was in his 20s, he felt like, well, there were historic events going on in the world, but he didn't feel like the people involved were historic. He wanted to work for someone who would be historic, who would be on the right side of history. And he writes, I wanted a hero, someone who could make sense of what was happening around me and in some way redeem it. And his hero was Barack Obama before he was even president, before he even had a legacy. He knew this guy is on the right side of history. It's their vision. Never mind the facts, never mind the actual history. And that, this attitude, this, you know, lying, tell a half-truth to make your point, that is right at the outset of Barack Obama's autobiography, Dreams from My Father. He tells this story about when he was 9 years old and he read this magazine about this boy who wanted to get skin treatment. He said he read this advertisement that they were trying to sell, you know, the white lifestyle. So they were encouraging black people to get skin treatment to become white because the white life was so much better. And this was like this turning point in his life. So when he's running in 2008, all the big media outlets, they pick up on this story. Well, this is great. This is a huge turning point. You know, he's really coming from this deeply divided and oppressed background. And they're trying to find this article that he references in his book, and it doesn't exist. He said it was in Life magazine. They have never seen that article from that year or any year. Obama thought, well, maybe it was in another magazine, and no one can find this article. It doesn't exist. He made up the story to illustrate, well, a point that may or may not be true. And when Obama's supporters, you know, they're trying to defend his story, they suggested that, well, Obama was after an emotional truth here. He was going for an emotional truth. It doesn't matter that the story wasn't true. The emotional truth was there. You know, what the point he is making was right. It doesn't matter if the history is true. Well, that's just simply called lying. You can't make up an event. I mean, there's nothing wrong with fiction and telling a story, but when you pawn it off as though it was something that happened and is true and it didn't, that's a lie. And then Ben Rhodes calls that book, Dreams from My Father, the Rosetta Stone to Obama's life and worldview. You know, it's fine to lie because we're altruistic. We're well-meaning. We are virtuous. We see the end, and it doesn't matter what the means are to get there. You know, the end justifies it. So we can do whatever we need to. Lie, lawlessness. And this brings me to the part of Rhodes' book that I was looking most forward to. And that is how he explains that New York Times article about the Iran echo chamber. And we cover this a lot at thetrumpet.com. And it wasn't a surprise to me that there was no contrition, no admission that it was wrong to mislead the media. Nothing about You know, I shouldn't have created a story to try and sell this deal. It was all about, well, this author, David Samuels, didn't give you all the context. He didn't give you all the facts. He just was going for sound bites. And in a lot of ways, you know, he's right about the media. The media should have been stronger. They should have gone after him more. But he knew exactly how to manipulate them, and he didn't have a problem with doing that. He had to take this idea that Hassan Rouhani coming into office was a moderate. It meant that America could, you know, it was an open door for the United States to make a deal with Iran. But Hassan Rouhani wasn't a moderate. It was just a good opportunity for them to bring it back to the forefront. So he creates this story that he is a moderate. He tells it to the experts. The experts tell it to the media. Everyone's citing the experts in the White House. And he just took this idea and he dropped it in the echo chamber, and it bounced around from all these different media outlets, and it was repeated enough until, you know, it comes out the other end and it's a fact. And you can't argue with facts. But no one ever asked where they came from, where that idea came from. Rhodes' only real defense here, and this is the only time he kind of acts with a little bit of humility, he says, David Samuels had caught me at a moment when I was too high on myself coming off the successes of 2015 and too embittered at the nature of the political and media world that I'd been at the center of for 7 years. So, you know, cut me a little slack. I didn't mean everything I said. I was high on my successes of 2015, but this article was huge. It revealed a lot about the way this administration functioned, and that is it's okay to lie if the ends are good. The ends justify the means. Barack Obama, Rhodes had to go face him after this. Not face him, but they were talking about it. And Obama says, "Why were you so eager to talk about how the sausage gets made? You've got to be more careful. We've still got 9 more months. He's okay with it. There's nothing wrong with the quotes about you calling the media the blob and duping the 27-year-old reporters in the press room. None of those quotes are fine, but why would you tell them that? You got to be more careful. There's no problem with what you did. It's that you spilled the beans." And then a few days later, Rhodes is sitting across from Obama, and Obama brings the article up again, and he says, "You know what that New York Times story got wrong?" Rhodes says, "Was it this?" And Obama says, "No." Obama says, "What they got wrong was the notion that there's something wrong with storytelling. I mean, that's our job, to tell a really good story about who we are. And sure, it's not wrong to tell a story, but what that Times article drew attention to was that it's wrong to intentionally deceive people with a story. It's wrong to make up a story with the intent to dupe people. You know, it's a lot like that story about the boy with the skin treatment that Obama told in his autobiography. It's an emotional truth. It doesn't matter if we lied." And then Obama goes on to talk about this book he's reading. He says, "I'm reading a good book now. It reminds you the ability to tell stories about who we are is what makes us different from animals. We're just chimps without it." Rhodes says that Obama described how all civilization, religion, nations were rooted in stories, which could be harnessed for good or bad. And then Ben Rhodes asks, "Well, what's the book that you're reading?" And Obama replies, "It's called Sapiens." And then he quickly changes the subject. And I just wanted to look at this book because I thought, well, it sounds really strange what he's reading. It's a pretty popular book. There's a lot of about psychology and evolution in there and concepts about how human beings function. But Obama left out the core essence of that book, the premise of that book, Sapiens. And I just thought this was very important when you consider the context of when he brings up this book. You know, Ben Rhodes had just manufactured a lie. He had just told a lie, and he was trying to get people to believe this fiction. And Obama says, "Well, there's nothing wrong with storytelling." But he doesn't specify, well, what kind of storytelling? Here's a soundbite from the author of the book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. He's a Hebrew author. He's by the name of Yuval Noah Harari. And he's talking here about the core premise of his book. He's talking about what he believes sets humans apart from the animals.
What enables us, alone of all the animals, to cooperate in such a way? The answer is our imagination. We can cooperate flexibly with countless numbers of strangers because we alone, of all the animals on the planet, can create and believe fictions, fictional stories. And as long as everybody believes in the same fiction, everybody obeys and follows the same rules, the same norms, the same values.
So his book isn't just about telling a good story. It's not just a story that sets us apart. It's fiction. Animals can only believe reality, and humans can believe things that aren't true. Again, I don't want to get into all of that, but isn't that telling? You know, right after Rhodes creates a fiction and he spews it out to the world, Barack Obama says there's nothing wrong with storytelling. You know, this book, it says this is what sets us apart. But what sets us apart is, well, we can believe fiction. And really, you get a summary right there of the entire administration. You know, if we can get everyone to believe fiction, if we can get them all to believe our lie, we'll be fine. It's fine to manufacture a story. Mr. Gerald Fleury writes in America Under Attack, "Are you willing to face reality? Most people are not. A haze of deception enshrouds our world. It's absolutely stunning how easily the people in this land today are duped. Adolf Hitler said that if you tell a lie, a big lie, and repeat it enough, eventually people will believe it. They certainly did in Germany. We are seeing bold, blatant lies become a bigger and bigger part of today's political landscape." And how many of those Obama-era stories are true? Or how many of them are just an emotional truth? A false story meant to illustrate a point. Look, you saw it with the Affordable Care Act. Remember the phrase, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. Or do you remember Jonathan Gruber? He's the MIT professor who was the architect of the Affordable Care Act. Remember what he said after that bill had passed through Congress?
It would not have passed. Okay, just like the lack of transparency is a huge political advantage. And basically, you know, call it the stupidity of the American voter or whatever. But basically, that was really, really critical to getting the thing to pass. And, you know, it's the second best argument. Look, I wish Mark was right, we can make it all transparent, but I'd rather have this law than not. So it's kind of like his reporter story. You know, yeah, there's things I wish I could change, but I'd rather have this law than not.
It's the vision of the anointed. We know what is right. We can't be transparent. We need to use, you know, the lack of transparency as a political tool because we are lying. We are not telling the truth. And until it passes, you know, then we can start saying it once it's a law. But, you know, what we're doing, it's for your own good because the American public doesn't know what's good for them. They have to trust us. We know what's right. So we need to keep them in the dark. Don't say anything about it. Just push it through because the end justifies the means. And those means are lying. It is lawlessness. It's bashing the Constitution. And Jonathan Gruber, he said that in 2013, while Obama was in his second term. And the media, you hear him on a few talk shows trying to justify his comment there, but there wasn't a big outcry about it. Mr. Fleury writes, "The mainstream media regularly just go along with what the president says, even at times when it can be easily proven false. What is causing such actions? What happens when most of the media just follow along with whatever the president says? What is going on? It seems the supposed professionals have lost all consciousness of their responsibility as journalists. Without a free and truthful media, a republic cannot stand. Why aren't more people talking about this dangerous trend? This is serious beyond measure." And, you know, the media, they haven't changed. They still swoon over Barack Obama, but now their patriotism is expressed in attacking President Trump. And you really look back at it and it's who, you know, look at that eternal legacy. It destroyed people's values. You know, we don't value the rule of law anymore. We don't value the Constitution. It's, you know, whatever your heart says is right, go ahead and do it. And that was very dangerous towards the end there. And we know that God saved America temporarily. You know, he's just stopped these anti-constitutional movements, stopped the lawlessness, and really, well, I shouldn't say stopped it, but is exposing it. Read Mr. Gerald Fleury's article, America Saved Temporarily. Go back through America Under Attack. It's just 40 pages. Those books are more valuable now than ever. And just think about the foresight of those things, or of that booklet being written, first off, in 2013. Well, I went a little longer than I was hoping to for that first segment, so hopefully we'll have a little time in the second segment. Go ahead and send any emails that you have to td@kpcg.fm. In the second half, we'll talk a little bit about one of Churchill's favorite poets, Rudyard Kipling. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the program. Mr. Fleury has talked a lot about William Manchester's biography of Winston Churchill, The Last Lion, and one theme, obviously, that runs throughout that entire series is Churchill's love of the empire. If you want to get on Churchill's good side, you talk and you write about the empire. He loved everything to do with it. This was his upbringing. And one of his favorite poets was a man named Rudyard Kipling. I'm not sure if Kipling admired Churchill as much or how strong their relationship was, but Kipling wrote about the empire, and he believed the empire was a force for good in the world, and that is an easy way to earn Churchill's love and respect. And we've talked a lot about learning to appreciate the things of the empire. And that's one thing that I really enjoy about Manchester's book is he gives you not just Churchill's perspective, but the culture at the time that was going on. And Churchill was really brought up and raised at the height of the British Empire. Rudyard Kipling was born in 1865 in India. Churchill spent a lot of time in India as well. So they're kind of brought up in the same era. Churchill was born 9 or 10 years after Kipling. And then Kipling died in the mid-1930s, 1936, just as the Nazis were rising in Germany and as Churchill was sounding the alarm. Richard Palmer has a great article about Rudyard Kipling. It is titled The Sceptered Isles Secular Prophet, and that is from the Trumpet print edition in 2015. February 2015, and that was the British issue, the Britain issue. And he talks a lot about Kipling as a secular prophet. He was warning through his poetry, and that did make him unpopular. And it's a really neat article going through some of his poems. And Kipling is probably most known for The Jungle Book and then for his poem If. If you haven't read If, go and read If by Rudyard Kipling. But I'd just like to encourage you to look at him more or to read more about Kipling just as leisure time. Mr. Fleury's talked a lot about using your leisure time productively and having an active mind. You know, maybe fill that time just before bed or when you're in the car reading a poem or two of Kipling. It's a neat way to even to learn history. It's mentally stimulating. You have to unlock the meaning of words and phrases, and you have to know the history. And Manchester brings this out in his second volume on page 23 about Churchill and how active his mind was. His leisure time was spent productively Manchester says his leisure reading, serious and frivolous, strengthens his grasp of his mother tongue. In Chartwell's library, one can glimpse the landscape of his mind, and then it lists through all of these huge books that Churchill was reading and studying. One of them is the King James Bible, and then it says that his favorite poets are Kipling, Huseman, and Rupert Brooke. So his leisure time was spent reading. He just picked a different subject, but his mind was always active. And Manchester notes that Churchill loved reciting Kipling. He would recite him his poems while he was in the bathtub a lot. But I just wanted to encourage you to maybe try to read a poem or two and just study or read some of them just to get more of a grasp on the culture of that time. One thing that I loved about the first volume of Manchester was he talks about, well, really the love of empire as it was starting out, or not starting out, but at least starting in Churchill's life. This is page 74 of volume 1. He says, "Home was sanctuary, a place of peace." This is not about Churchill, but just the culture at the time. "Home was sanctuary, a place of peace and stability, with sturdy furniture in which evenings were spent reading aloud. Whence the family departed for church and reunions with grandparents, uncles, aunts, and cousins, and where children were trained to assure the continuity of generations to come. Keeping the empire growing, strong, and most beautiful would be the solemn legacy of these children." And he talks about how their lives revolved around the family. They were raising them, and it was the culture of the empire. It was studying empire. And you see this love of Kipling early on in the late 1800s, the late 19th century. And then as it became more fashionable to despise empire, you see Kipling's popularity wane. And people lost interest in the empire. And he wrote about that. He wrote that in his poems. And you can read about those in Richard's article. He goes through and brings out a lot of these prophetic poems about the decline of empire. In his book, Churchill, The Watchman, Mr. Fleury writes, "True imperialism develops manhood," Churchill said. "That is politically incorrect today, but it is still very accurate. True imperialism, the expansion of an empire rooted in law and morality, does create quality men and women. Churchill was a masculine man, a courageous, selfless individual. It was largely the British Empire that made him a real leader, one of the greatest in our time." It was the empire. It was the sense of duty. It was something beyond yourself. You had a duty to spread and to build this empire. And it wasn't obviously a perfect empire, but the goal there of law and order, a culture that respects those fundamentals, that's a good thing to spread around the world. Kipling knew that. Churchill understood that. And I would just like to read a couple of Kipling's poems. These aren't exactly about the empire, but just to help you, you know, really learn to appreciate and to enjoy the culture of that time. This has been something, certainly not something that I was brought up on reading a lot about British literature. So I'm learning to appreciate it more and more. And I love studying about culture here and about these men who had this sense of duty. And they really created this culture. It's the culture of the empire. So I'll just read a couple of poems here just to, you know, in hopes of maybe getting you excited to read these before bed, maybe one or two before bed, or if you're in the car, and, you know, use them as a tool. Use them as a time to just spend time together as a family or as a couple and just learn to appreciate this culture of the empire. This one is titled "The Children's Song," and this is Rudyard Kipling. "Land of our birth, we pledge to thee our love and toil in the years to be, when we are grown and take our place as men and women with our race. Father in heaven, who lovest all, O help thy children when they call, that they may build from age to age an undefiled heritage. Teach us to bear the yoke in youth with steadfastness and careful truth, that in our time thy grace may give the truth whereby the nations live. Teach us to rule ourselves alway, controlled and cleanly, night and day, that we may bring, if need arise, no maimed or worthless sacrifice. Teach us to look in all our ends on thee for judge and not our friends, that we with thee may walk uncowed by fear or favor of the crowd. Teach us the strength that cannot seek by deed or thought to hurt the weak, that under thee we may possess man's strength to comfort man's distress. Teach us delight in simple things and mirth that has no bitter springs, forgiveness free of evil done, and love to all men beneath the sun. Land of our birth, our faith, our pride, for whose dear sake our fathers died, O motherland, we pledge to thee, heart, and hand through the years to be. So that comes through there. There's this sense of duty, this sense of empire. And I love, just the message that is to for young people there. Teach us to bear the yoke in youth. We have to work hard and serve the empire. And a lot of his other poems, he talks about, it's an honor to be a sailor in Her Majesty's Navy or His Majesty's Navy. It's an honor to serve crown and country. And Kipling, he had that ingrained, as a young boy. He grew up in India. He saw the empire and believed this is the best force for good in the world. And he was helping to create a culture that would spread the empire, that would help it to grow. Here's another one that I personally like. I read it the other day and I couldn't. It was just really funny and entertaining to read, thinking about Ed Stone, especially, and just the people we have around here and everyone working together. We're in England. This one is titled The Glory of the Garden. Our England is a garden that is full of stately views, of borders, beds, and shrubberies, and lawns and avenues, with statues on the terraces and peacocks strutting by, but the glory of the garden lies in more than meets the eye. For where the old thick laurels grow along the thin red wall, you will find the tool and potting sheds, which are the heart of all. The cold frames and the hot houses, the dung pits and the tanks, the rollers, carts, and drain pipes with the barrows and the planks. And there you'll see the gardeners, the men and prentice boys, told off to do as they are bid and do it without noise. For except when seeds are planted and we shout to scare the birds, the glory of the garden, it abideth not in words. And some can pot begonias and some can but a rose, and some are hardly fit to trust with anything that grows. But they can roll and trim the lawns and sift the sand and loam, for the glory of the garden occupieth all who come. Our England is a garden, and such gardens are not made by singing, oh, how beautiful, and sitting in the shade. While better men than we go out and start their working lives at grubbing weeds from gravel paths with broken dinner knives. There's not a pair of legs so thin, there's not a head so thick, there's not a hand so weak and white, nor yet a heart so sick. But it can find some needful job that's crying to be done, for the glory of the garden glorifieth every one. Then seek your job with thankfulness and work till further orders, if it's only netting strawberries or killing slugs on borders. And when your back stops aching and your hands begin to harden, you will find yourself a partner in the glory of the garden. O, Adam was a gardener, and God who made him sees that half a proper gardener's work is done upon his knees. So when your work is finished, you can wash your hands and pray for the glory of the garden, that it may not pass away. And the glory of the garden, it shall never pass away. I was just kind of fitting everyone into these profiles here. I would be the person, and some are hardly fit to trust with anything that grows. And you just get this image of everybody working here, and it's not about, just sitting there and appreciate it. It's about the work that goes into it and everybody contributing. There's always a job to be done. And if you're sitting around, well, be thankful. Go find a job and just keep looking for orders and make this land beautiful. And I just have this picture of Ed Stone and everyone here when we first got here and running around and doing their part. And then it ends there talking about prayer. And a lot of these poets, Churchill, He studied the Bible. Kipling studied the Bible. These men knew their Bible. I'll just conclude with one quote here. I wanted to get to a few more poems, but hopefully that will whet your appetite and encourage you to get into it a little bit more. You can buy, you know, one of his books. I think this one is just called Rudyard Kipling's Verse, and that's $3 or $4 or pounds on Amazon. And there's hundreds of poems in here, and it's great to just go through this book. And I'll conclude here with a quote from Mr. Gerald Fleury. This is from the Royal Vision, January-February 2015. This article is titled Shakespeare and the British Empire. God gives us many examples to get our minds on the world tomorrow. Even Solomon's reign was a type of the wonderful world tomorrow, and I believe that, in a way, the great British Empire gives us good insight into what is about to come on the earth. Some really exciting things happened in that empire, and God wants it to be that way in our lives. So study some of this culture. Get excited about those positive aspects of the empire. And I think all of you have that vision and see the spiritual parallels there. Well, I am out of time for today. Thank you for listening. Mr. Fleury will be back tomorrow. Leave your or email your comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.